Radio Mission, Two Men, One Podcast, Every Black Film Ever Made. My name is Vincent Williams, and I'm joined as always by my partner.
Hey, what's up? How do I get your boy? This is Len, a.k.a. The Bat Tribble.
And tonight, we begin my favorite month, Octavia April, a month where we devote all of our episodes to black science fiction. Mm-hmm. And tonight, we will begin with Lynn's selection, 2023's The Creator. But before we get to all of that, how are you, Lynn?
I am doing great, Vincent. How are you?
I am doing well as well.
That is cool. Welcome to each and every one of you out there who are watching us as we stream live from Yunk Junk, Philadelphia's premier video podcast palace here in Manayunk, PA. As we stream to all points north, south, east, and west, that means Twitter, that means Facebook, and that means to all of you in the chat on YouTube. Hello, missionaries.
Good evening, one and all.
As Vincent mentioned, we are in the month of April, looking at all films of science fiction in honor of the late mother of Afrofuturism herself, author Octavia Butler.
Yes, sir.
I was actually hard-pressed to think if Octavia Butler is rightfully.
Absolutely.
The mother of Afrofuturism, mm-hmm. probably the foremost. Would you say that she's the foremost black author, period, of science fiction?
I mean, she's certainly the most relevant and most identifiable one, I would say.
I was trying to think, because I'm not being as much of a book reader as you are. I was hard-pressed to even think of another black male author.
I mean, of course, Samuel Delaney.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the great Samuel Delaney. I think the compliment and the insult with Sam Delaney is that his books, frankly, are so dense that more people know about them
than have actually read
them.
What's his big one?
Nevryon.
Nevryon.
Yeah.
What's never young?
It is post-apocalyptic.
What time period are we talking about this?
Oh, my goodness. Never Young came out probably. Actually, Never Young is fantasy slash science fiction. Probably the 70s. I mean, he's been writing since the 60s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's like his epic. That would be like
that was his prime time.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tales of Nevryon. But,
it was a series.
It was, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, probably the 70s and 80s.
And his work has never been adapted in any type of way? Not even in like for television?
Mm-mm, not at all.
Certainly not for movies.
Is
it because it's just that dense?
I would say so.
I mean, but Lord of the Rings seems dense and that's been adapted multiple times.
You know, and we'll talk about this. I think there is dense as in the world building and then it's dense as in the plot.
Okay.
And for all of the world building and everything that you get in something like Lord of the Rings,
the plot is very simple.
It's a pretty linear plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
we're going on a journey.
We got the thing. We got to destroy the thing.
Right.
You know, it's funny. Adam and I just starred The Hobbit.
Okay.
And, you know, The Hobbit is basically we got to go and get the thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the dwarves are going to get the dragon. Gold, and then that's when Bilbo gets the ring and everything kind of goes. But yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
But that's not Never Yawned. No,
I can't even really quite describe it.
I'm seeing because you're like doing everything but describing the story.
I am. So.
Okay. All right. Well, before we get into the show, ladies and gentlemen, we would be remiss if we did not take the opportunity to do what we did not have the opportunity to do last week. And that is to share our condolences with the family of the late, great Lou Gossett Jr.
Oh, my goodness.
Passed away a few days ago. Louis Gossett Jr., who was, as far as I know, most recently seen in The Color Purple.
Yeah.
I think he may have. I think he still had a couple of projects that were in the pipeline.
Yeah.
To come out. But certainly the last time I saw him on screen was in the most recent adaptation of the stage play, The Color Purple. Yeah. Louis Gossett Jr., Academy Award winning actor for his supporting role in An Officer and a Gentleman. And someone who has come up periodically on the Michaud Mission is actually curious of how infrequently his name has come across.
Yeah, so he's like he's in the apartment. I mean the
not the apartment.
The landlord.
The landlord.
He's in the landlord. He's of course in A Raisin in the Sun.
Mm-hmm. And then he's a spook who's this is not spook who's stepped by the door. That's not
which
him.
We haven't done.
No, but I'm thinking, but it no, we haven't done that.
No, no.
Why did I watch that movie?
I don't know. Because you like movies.
Probably.
And then, you know, I mentioned it a few weeks ago, something that, frankly, I had shortlisted for this month, Enemy Mine.
I know. Mm-hmm. It's your movie.
Yeah.
That is your movie, man.
Yeah.
So, what are your thoughts on Louis Gossett Jr.?
I mean, just part of the, I mean, look, if you're our age, if you're a Gen X person, he really is just in the fabric of our lives. Like we talked about The Color Purple, but, you know, frankly, you know, we know him from Roots.
That's what I say. Television.
Chicken George and.
You know him from Good Times.
I know him from Good Times and The Jeffersons.
He was on The Jeffersons.
Yeah, he
played. The Good Times is the famous
Good
role.
Times, he plays the cousin
right.
that goes in about Michael, because remember, Michael wasn't performing as well as he thought he would, because now he was in the advanced classes.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid, he was picking on the one kid who was doing better than Michael. But then he was also on an episode of The Jeffersons where he was George Jefferson's friend from the military, from the Army. I think George was in the Army and he kept flirting with Wheezy.
I do not even remember
when George
this.
Wasn't around. Like he was grabbing around the waist and stuff.
What?
Yeah, he was a wild boy.
I do not remember that.
He was. Right. So he's on that one episode of Good Times. I might be mixing. He's not the other. He wasn't on two episodes of Good Times, was he? Remember the guy?
I think he was on two
remember
episodes.
Remember the guy who was dating Thelma who was deaf?
That wasn't him.
That wasn't him?
No. I don't know.
Okay.
No, Louis Gossett was too old to be dating Thelma.
I mean.
No.
All right.
No, I'm pretty sure. Now, they'll correct me in the chat if they will, but I'm pretty sure he wasn't.
I think you're right, though. Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, I mean, Louis Gossett. And you know, frankly, I thought he did
and you
not
talked
look
about, excuse me, you talked about him on Roots. Roots was, that was some work.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, frankly, I didn't think he looked well in The Color Purple.
You know what? I thought about that, too, because, you know, even at his age, he still is Louis Gossett Jr.
Yeah.
Right. Because you and I was thinking about how, you know, strong he looked in Watchmen. Remember, he was in Watchmen.
Say, 2 or 3 years ago, he was magnificent.
Right.
In Watchmen.
But I thought it was, I noticed that in The Color Purple, he's there, but he don't have a lot of lines.
And I noticed he never stands up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like you never see him walking into a scene.
He's always sitting.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, Mr. Gossett doesn't look well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But, you know, great loss.
A great loss. An actor who I think, despite his Academy Award, that he rightfully won, but it came at that time where some would say, no matter who you were, if you won an Academy Award, sometimes now your quote goes up so much that people just, they don't even book you, which then is going to be a double-edged sword if you're a black actor
in
the 70s and 80s, and that happens too. But I think that he is someone who kind of didn't get his just due.
Not at all.
You know what I mean?
You know, I think he was frankly typecast for years after An Officer and a Gentleman. Like he was in that Top Gun knockoff series, Iron Eagle.
Yeah, and I think he's in like at least four of those.
He's in like four of those.
And God bless him, I ain't mad at the man. Cash a check.
And here you go. Here's a deep cut. Remember, he was on the short-lived science fiction show. What is it? The Power of Matthew Starr.
Was he on that? I remember that show. I didn't know he was on that show.
Yeah, he played the black guy father figure, the gruff black guy father figure. I mean, he did, like, it really was a case, like, because he was so good. And when's the last time you watched An Officer and a Gentleman?
I've never seen An Officer and a Gentleman.
How is that even possible?
I know. I haven't wanted to see it.
See, this is why... Sometimes I actually don't like doing this live because stuff like this happens that just completely throws me. Why did you not want to see An Officer and a Gentleman?
Just something about it, just it didn't interest me. It seemed like, you know, with the title, I knew the story, so I didn't really care. The most interesting part about it was Louis Gossett Jr. won the Academy Award. God bless him. I didn't want to see it. Now,
add me to the list of people that say it's really good.
Now, that being said, I am in the middle of and will go home and probably finish watching An American Gigolo. So perhaps that will get me to the next Richard Gere movie.
Is Richard Gere better in An Officer and a Gentleman than American Gigolo?
Oh, he's got to be. Not that he's bad in American Gigolo, but...
I think you don't like him in American Gigolo.
No, I said not that he's bad in that, but I'm just saying because it's like he's older, slightly older, a little bit more seasoned.
His character might be a little bit more nuanced in American Gigolo.
Really? See, I haven't gotten to the meat of of it yet.
He's really good, but you know, frankly,
I'm still stuck by Bill Duke is in the movie with hair.
Yes.
An afro at
yes. That. Come on back. Louis Gossett Jr. 100% steals the movie from him, though.
In Officer and a Gentleman.
Yeah. But he's good. It's a really good movie.
I perhaps will one day see it.
Okay. Well, rest in peace.
I'll watch it when you watch The Apartment. Look, it's too much to ask. It's too much of an ask. I can lend you The Apartment.
It's not too much to ask. I'm trying to determine if I think American Gigolo is more important than The Apartment. Because would you say that's Billy Wilder's best film?
Well, first of all, you meant an Officer and a Gentleman.
Right, an officer.
And would I say that The Apartment is Billy Wilder's best film? That's a good question. I don't think it's... No.
Like, gun to my head, I got to watch three Billy Wilder films. Name them.
The Apartment...
You start with The Apartment of the three.
Well, only because it's the first thing off my mind. But in the running for good Billy Wilder films is Ace in a Hole. And then you pick them between Stalag 17 or Sunset Boulevard.
Some Like It Hot isn't Billy Wilder?
Some Like It Hot is up there, too. But you said Gun to My Head 3.
That I have to watch.
Yeah, so... The Apartment gives you...
You're a little hipster right now. Like
No.
All right.
The Apartment gives you good drama, but it is funny, too.
No. I'm sorry. Let me reframe the question. Introduction to Billy Porter.
Billy Wilder.
Introduction to Billy Wilder. Like, you have a 16-year-old. You got to show him three Billy Wilder films to introduce him to Billy Wilder.
To why Billy Wilder the Billy Wilder that everybody...
Right.
The Apartment, Ace in a Hole. And now, because of that, I'm probably going to Sunset Boulevard.
So not... Some Like It Hot.
Because Some Like It Hot is great. And I love Some Like It Hot.
Okay.
But Some Like It Hot is very much a straightforward comedy.
Yes.
Yes, it is. But I think you get as funny as that movie is, it's also like a bit of a one joke throughout the whole movie.
Yes.
I think you get just as much laughs, but better story and a better reason, idea of who Billy Wilder is as a director from the other three movies that I named.
All right.
Not knocking Some Like It. I love Some Like It Hot.
Of course you do. Of course you do. But you should watch An Officer and a Gentleman.
If you say so.
I mean, it's one of the great movies.
I said I would watch it when you watch The Apartment.
Right. Which,
and The Apartment is a more important film than An Officer and a Gentleman.
Not for us. Because Louis Gossett Jr. isn't in it.
Fair enough.
Rest in peace, Louis Gossett Jr.
Get to Billy Wilder.
I did.
The magic of the mission.
Because I just don't understand the holes in your viewing sometimes. You are a mystery sometimes. Like, how have you not seen An Officer and a Gentleman? Like, how are you our age and you never saw it? Like, you intentionally avoided it. And this is me talking.
Yes.
Like, you intentionally avoided An Officer and a Gentleman for 35 years.
And counting.
And I thought maybe there was some reason, like some actual reason.
There is a reason.
I can say, oh, okay. There's the reason.
I don't want to say it.
All right. Come on. Come on, Luce.
Can we move on?
Please. Yes.
We have emails.
Oh, yes. All right. Let's.
It is time for missives from the missionary.
So what else is going on, Lynn?
We have emails, Vincent.
Ooh, missives from the missionaries.
Ooh. 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 Missives from the missionaries.
Missives from the missionaries, ladies and gentlemen, where I look at the emails that you send in to us at michelmission@gmail.com. Vincent, we have an email from Michael Sykes.
Hey, what's up, Michael?
About the magnificent Lou Gossett Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Len and Vincent. I was saddened to hear the great Lou Gossett Jr. had passed away. On my introduction to him, there were three touchstones.
Mm-hmm.
Enemy Mine.
Of course.
Digstown.
Interesting.
And an episode of The Partridge Family.
Oh, that's
with
right.
With Richard Pryor playing his brother.
Yeah.
Enemy Mine will always hold a dear special place in my heart. That was one of the first movies that had me in my feelings. Lou Gossett will be missed, but not forgotten. The chemistry between Richard Pryor and Louis Gossett was so good. They fit together like a hand in glove. That episode always made me wish that Richard Pryor and Lou Gossett Jr. worked together more. Do you see, Vincent, Richard Pryor and Lou Gossett Jr. starring in a movie together? And if so, what will the genre and plot be? Your friend Michael Sykes. I mean, they could have starred in a whole bunch. You know what? I'm curious what the Bill Cosby, Sidney Poitier movies would have looked like with Richard Pryor and Louis Gossett Jr.
I was just thinking that.
In the role.
Because Louis Gossett Jr. has a movie from the 70s called, I think it's called Skin Game. And I forget who his white co-star is, but it's set during the 1800s,
mm-hmm.
and they are con men,
mm-hmm.
where Louis Gossett Jr. pretends to be enslaved, and his co-star pretends to, well, be a slave owner, and then they run hustles. And it's this sort of kind of dark, sharp humor that you got in the 70s.
It's James Garner.
And you know me, James Garner got me to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Louis Gossett Jr. Kept me there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a still kind of.
Is that what it's called? Skin Game?
Skin Game.
Yeah. Skin Game.
Would you buy a used slave from this man, James Garner, mm-hmm. Lou Gossett Jr.? And this is when he was just going by Lou Gossett.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, wow. There's a movie. There's a movie for you. No, I was thinking about the Cosby Poitier movies, because especially the first one,
mm-hmm.
where Cosby is kind of like playing a little slicker.
Yeah.
And I could see that fall right into Richard's wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then Louis Gossett Jr., definitely one of the more handsome men you've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
would definitely fit into that every man role,
yeah.
of Sidney Poitier.
Yeah.
But actually what got me there.
But a little quicker than Sidney.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And what, yep. but, and here's the thing. And what actually got me to thinking that was because my first thought was to put them not so much in all three of the films, but I was thinking of the last film where we said they both were maybe a little bit too old, mm-hmm. playing the roles that they did. Richard, and I think Louis Gossett could have got that yeah. one over. That was what? Piece of the Action?
Piece of the Action.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be my call on that one.
I want to watch Skin Game. Oh, is Skin Game in print?
That's a good question.
We're going to do Skin Game in the next few months.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got no problem
with that. It seems like something that would have slipped out of print, though.
Hey, you don't want to put this back in print? Nah, I think we're good. Yeah, I think we're good on that. Yeah,
because it really is kind of Blazing Saddles type, you know, real sharp, real, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we can let that one slide.
Yeah.
Let that one slide into public domain. Yeah,
I know that. I know sometimes when you Google something, it'll have watch now. If it's not up, that's fine.
I didn't see that up
okay,
there.
Okay.
And right. I'm on to the next email.
Yeah.
And this email is from Lisa Alexander.
Hey, what's up, Lisa?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I hope things are going well in your neck of the woods. I'm still making my way through the back catalog,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and made it to the COVID years.
Oh, the COVID years.
COVID years of the Michaud Mission.
COVID years of the Michaud Mission.
When we were learning to do video. Ooh.
Oh,
ooh,
boy.
Ooh, it was rough.
It's a real time capsule, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the Serafina Black Orpheus episode.
Yeah.
I enjoyed your deep dive into Hamilton and the way you extol the talents of Renee Elise Goldsberry.
Mm.
Imagine my surprise that you did not mention her guest starring role on Star Trek Enterprise episode Vox Sola. It's not a good episode, but it's certainly not the worst Enterprise episode. And Miss Goldsberry was solid in it. Yeah, the Star Trek Enterprise, which I have fond feelings for. I can't say I remember every one of the episodes.
Yeah, my Star Trek blasphemy is I don't know if I watched all of Enterprise.
Okay. Fair.
Like maybe
half of the episodes.
Half
so of like the first season into the second, and then you were right, out.
Like I watched the Mirror episodes,
mm-hmm.
of course, because you kind of have to. And I think maybe the last three or four, like when they said it was going off, I said,
"Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. They did that show wrong." Anyway, Lisa continues.
Okay.
I also really enjoyed your discussion on A Goofy Movie.
Mm.
I love that film. And though I don't think of it as a black film, it is one of the blacker Disney films, which probably wasn't intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in subsequent episodes that Len took some heat for choosing that film. And I wonder, did you feel vindicated after Atlanta dedicated an entire episode
mm-hmm.
to creating a black backstory mm-hmm. for that film? The goof who sat by the door is a ridiculous 30 minutes of television, and I know there are folks who didn't realize the episode was a mockumentary until after the fact. Don't let anyone knock your choices unless it's during Mother May I. That's what I say. And honestly, I was absolutely fine with, you know, the backlash. People could say what they felt. You know, that's why we do the mission, mm-hmm. you know, to have this discussions about what is and what is not a black film.
Sure.
So I was fine.
Sure. And to your point, as much as there was a little bit of, I'm assuming somebody wrote in and says something about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
in these, I don't know how old you are, Lisa, but in these blurred worlds that we travel in, there are blurreds of a certain age that ride for the Goofy movie.
That is very true.
Like, they ride for the Goofy movie.
That is very true.
So don't you worry. Lin has swords.
Most definitely. With
his that have his back for the Goofy movie.
Lisa continues, since you are now including films that straddle the line of black film, wait for it, Vincent, I think a solid entry would be Bring It On. The way the film handles cultural appropriation is quite progressive, and it would be worthwhile to discuss the fact that Gabrielle Union hasn't aged a damn age since that film was released 24 years ago. Thanks for all you do, Lisa. Well, Gabrielle Union, we have established, is indeed a vampire. It does not surprise me that she has not aged.
Also like to point out, when Gabrielle Union comes up, an acquaintance of mine is very good friends with her.
Really?
And by all accounts, Gabrielle Union is actually prettier in person.
See, and that's great to hear.
Like, I've never met her, but like, I have like people, like three or four people around me have met her, and they all say she's actually prettier in person.
Okay. See, And I think that's a beautiful story. But what I'm hearing is that we're 2 degrees from Gabrielle Union being a guest on the Michomish.
Sure, sure, sure. Degrees are a funny thing.
Oh, well.
From your mouth to God's ears. But yeah, I love Bring It On. And we have talked about Bring It On several times throughout the years.
You always bring it up. And I don't bring it up. Yeah, I've never seen it. No one won an Oscar award for Bring It On.
No one won an Oscar for Bring It On.
I don't think I will be, you know, raked over the coals for not seeing Bring It On.
But as Lisa says, it is a film that has a certain level of resonance in the culture.
It does.
And I think the story behind Bring It On is fascinating. Like, one little factoid that Gabrielle Union talks about, like the character that she plays and the black characters in the plot, how they were done dirty, how they made the film, they showed it to test audiences. The test audiences really responded to Gabrielle Union's character and the other black cheerleaders. And do you know that the studio shot additional footage to put in the commercials to make people think that the Clovers were the cheerleaders that Gabrielle Union's crew was, to make people think that the Clovers were going to be in the movie more than they were?
Really?
Yep. Yep. So Gabrielle Union has talked about that and talked about that character. And I'm a big fan of the film, so.
Wow.
Yeah. But if you look at the trailer, you think that the Clovers are in the movie much more than they are.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay. See, now I want to see Bring It On.
Okay.
You've got, now I'm there.
It's a good movie. It's a good movie, you know, even without the fact that Gabrielle Union isn't in it as much as she should have been. It's still a good movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. All right. Well, that's our emails, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to hear your email read on air, please take the time, jot a note, and email us at michomission@gmail.com. That's michaeuxmission at gmail.com. Or if you really want to help our show, there's 2 ways that you can help our show, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, we are a fledgling little YouTube show right now. So if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button and the bell so that you will be not only one of us, another missionary joining us along the ride on the mission, but you'll be notified when we put new videos up on our YouTube channel. If you want to think of another way that you can help us, then please, on the podcast catcher of your choice, especially if it's Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating and, if you are so moved, a review, and tell us what you think of our show. every time we build up our subscriber numbers and every time we build up our number of reviews, Apple and YouTube think about us that much more and put us in front of that many more people that may like the things that we like. Black films, and showing them the appreciation that they deserve.
The magic word is algorithm, ladies and gentlemen, and people who don't identify by any gender.
Case in point, Nerds RPG Variety Cast left us a review on Apple.
Thank
just
you.
The other day.
Thank you, Nerds RPG
Variety Cast.
Variety Cast.
I have listened for years and am sorry it has taken this long to leave a review. The knowledge and perspective of the hosts make this one of the best movie podcasts, pop culture podcasts, really, on the air. Everyone, regardless of race, should check out this wonderful podcast. It really does have a quality that crosses over to appeal to all lovers of cinema. Thank you so much for that review.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for us to journey into the world of the superlatives.
Okay.
Where there can only be the top five.
Top five. Who's your top five?
Top five, ladies and gentlemen, where I come up with a list. Vincent gives us his scintillating conversation or commentary on it. And Vincent, in celebration of Octavia April, as we are celebrating the works of science fiction by Black creatives.
Yes.
In honor of our mom's namesake, Octavia Butler,
yes,
who was a noted author
absolutely
of Afrofuturistic tales and science fiction,
who has a number of works
in pre-production.
Yeah,
some have gone to have actually premiered. There was a Kindred series last year. What I have here are a top five other works, not of Octavia Butler, but recent works of Black science fiction, Afrofuturism, that I contend, based on what I'm reading, are ready for the screen.
Oh, neat.
I don't know how many of these products or, you know, books you are familiar with.
Okay.
One of them I am, and I'm in the midst of reading.
Okay.
But this is the top five.
All right. Excellent. Let's hear them.
Starting with number five.
Of course.
From Justina Ireland, Dread Nation, which is at once provocative, terrifying, and darkly subversive. Dread Nation is Justina Ireland's stunning vision of an America both foreign and familiar, a country on the brink at the explosive crossroads where race, humanity, and survival meet. It is an alternate history set in 19th century United States, where in this timeline, the Civil War ends when zombies emerge from their graves at Gettysburg.
Oh, no.
The enslaved are then freed, but Black and Indigenous children are then trained to fight the undead and protect the nation.
Damn, even in alternate history,
we still got work to do.
All right. Well, that sounds fun.
Are you familiar with Dread Nation?
I'm not. I'm
really? This is a book that a fan of the show, Arielle Johnson of Amalgam Comics, she introduced this book to me.
Okay.
It was on sale at Amalgam. And I think I was literally at the counter with a bunch of comics, and she came and put it on top of the comics and said, buy this.
Love that.
I was like, okay. And I started reading it, and I was like, I actually loved it. And I'm not... You know me, I'm not a reader of books. And I'm not a reader of horror.
Yeah, I was about to say.
But this was...
I know you don't do horror.
But this was like, it was horror, but tinged with the slavery aspect of it. I was with it.
Okay.
And I do like history, and I love an alternate history story.
Yeah,
I love
good alternate history.
So this was like right up my alley.
All right, put that on the list to read.
Yeah, man. And there's a sequel, The Deathless Divide. So,
okay.
So I'm admittedly, it's taken me a little over a year to finish it just because of life. Mm-hmm. But I want to get through it so I can get the next book. But yeah, the Dread Nation. And some may say the zombie, you know, phase of movies has gone, but they always come back.
Sure.
So if there's like a lull.
And if it's done well.
And if it's done well, it will find an audience, you know? And I think this is something that definitely find an audience. All right?
All right.
So there you go. So that's number five.
Number five.
Number four.
Mm-hmm.
This is from P.D. Clark, the mm-hmm. author, a master of the djinn. Clark sets this novel in an alternative version of 1912 Cairo,
mm-hmm.
where the veil between the magical and the mundane worlds was lifted 50 years earlier. The dapper Fatma is one of the few women agents working for the Ministry of Alchemy and one of the best. When a secret society is murdered with magical means, she's placed in charge of the case. But meanwhile, she has to train a young woman rookie to. She has a new young woman rookie to train, and her girlfriend is back in town with a magical masked entity causing havoc and djinn keeping secrets. Agent Fatma has her hands full. It is a richly imagined world and characters, and its high stakes and thrilling plot. This novel would make such a fantastic show in the vein of The Nethers or Carnival Row, but better. This is according to Margaret Kingsbury of BuzzFeed.
Okay.
And that sounds real interesting because I'm reading I've fallen into the idea of the djinn, you know, like genies,
mm-hmm.
Because I've read the comic book with 8 million djinns.
8 million, 8 billion wishes.
8 billion wishes. Right. I don't know if you've read it. It's
one of my favorite series of the past 10 years.
It's so
smart.
Good. Very smart. So when I saw this, I was like, yo, if this is half as smart as that, which it sounds like it's marrying like, you know, some kind of like spy novel mm-hmm. type of, you know, adventure with this element of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there for it. I think that is something that could kill. And I love that. I'm a sucker for a movie that can make a woman of color like the action hero
Absolutely.
That they deserve to be.
Yeah.
I'm all for it.
All right.
All right. So obviously that's another one that you're not familiar with.
No, I'm not.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Next, number three. From Nigerian British writer Tade Thompson.
Okay.
Is Rosewater.
Okay.
When an alien biodome suddenly appears in Nigeria, the city of Rosewater forms around it. The appearance of the biodome triggers psychic powers among some. These people are called sensitives. When the biodome opens, it has the ability to heal, though it also reanimates any corpse left nearby. Once a thief, Caro is hired as a S-45 agent for his psychic powers. However, when he realizes that other sensitives like him are dying in mysterious ways, he begins to investigate, which leads him to believe that sensitives are being murdered. This Rosewater was also followed by two sequels, The Rosewater Insurrection and The Rosewater Redemption, which were both published in 2019. I just like the whole idea of this whole story being set in Africa.
Yeah. You know,
with this.
Yeah.
And it kind of almost reminded me a little bit in thinking about it, how vibranium kind of like transformed the lives mm-hmm. of,
Wakanda. Sounds like the Great Mound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like something like that, like this biodome all of a sudden giving all the people that lived around it, this, this, powers.
Mm-hmm.
That sounded real interesting. Yeah, to me. I like that.
3 for 3. I'm not familiar with this. This is a good list.
I like
jotting notes down.
I like the world building of that. Number two. From author C.L. Polk is Witchmark. Witchmark takes place in the Edwardian England-esque fantasy world Aeland, where noble families hone their magical gifts, attempting to control their country and beyond. Each book in the trilogy focuses on a different character. Miles hides his magical healing gifts because he doesn't want to become a part of his wealthy family's political maneuverings. He treats soldiers returning home from the war at a psychiatric hospital. His sister Grace is a cunning politician and magic user who's attempting to deal with her family's history of cruelty and oppression, while Robin Thorpe is a witch in hiding who longs for a free and just island. With lots of romance, intrigue, compelling characters, this would make for a great series. The trilogy continued on with Storm Song and Soul Star. This is also another choice by writer Margaret Kingsbury on BuzzFeed.
Okay.
That sounds real interesting. That appealed to me because of thinking, I always had an idea for a kind of like this time of England, like she's saying, like King Edward, like, you know, like that time of England-ish story that had to deal with black people of color.
Sure, sure.
And I think there is something rich to pull out of something like that. And this sounds like it's right up in that wheelhouse.
4 for 4. I've not heard of that either.
You know, and number one, and this is from probably the preeminent black science fiction author of certainly of the last few years.
Okay.
N.K. Jemisin.
Yes.
The Broken Earth trilogy.
Yes.
The fifth season was their 2015 novel. That was awarded the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place on a planet with a single supercontinent called the Stillness. Every few centuries, its inhabitants endure what they call a fifth season of catastrophic climate change. In the prologue, an extraordinarily powerful Orogen discusses the sad state of the world and laments the oppression of his people. He then uses his enormous power to fracture the entire continent across its length, threatening to cause the worst fifth season in recorded history. The story then follows three female Orogenes, Essen, Demea, and Sinite, from across the Stillness. Is the first of three books, and is followed by the Obelisk Gate and the Stone Sky. And all three books mark the N.K. Jemisin as the first person to win the Hugo Award 3 years in a row and for all three books in a trilogy. Now, I should say, because all of these are projects that are waiting to be adapted.
Mm-hmm.
I should say that in 2017,
because I know these have been optioned,
the fifth season was announced to be adapted for television by TNT with David Diggs attached as an executive producer.
Mm-hmm.
However, with the changes since 2017, with Discovery buying Warner Brothers, which is the owner of TNT, and TNT being more or less being pushed out of the narrative storytelling space, this project has got kind of like gone to sat in production hell.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if they're kind of trying to wait for the option to run out so that somebody else can just scoop this thing up. Because like you said, N.K. Jemisin is a name not to be messed with.
Yeah.
And this is like you have to imagine there are people that just counting the clock on that contract to expire so they can grip this up.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a property that, you know, people used to throw around the the terms, oh, it's the next Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, if they do this right.
That's the rub. You got to do it right.
You got to do it right.
But here's the one thing that what little I know of N.K. Jemisin gives me, you know, makes me feel good about the prospects of them doing it right. She strikes me as a woman who has not a F in her pocket.
No, no, she doesn't. And, you know, her and Nnamdi Okafor, they really are the heirs apparent to Octavia Butler. Like they're the two.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I actually started to put Binti by Okafor.
And if I were going to put something on this list, I would have put Binti.
Yeah, but Binti has been option. I think I believe the note I saw that it was in production.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't make the.
And that's another one. If they do Binti right.
Yeah. Yeah. Binti was. Woo.
Like, people aren't really ready for Binti.
Well, you know, they weren't. But you know what? That's the excuse that people were making for Octavia Butler all
this. That's true. That is true.
You know?
Well, that's a good list. That's a good list, and 4 out of 5 I've never heard of. So
there you go.
Got some reading to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is the top five. So now it's time for us to continue on our royal streak and take you to the Game of Kings.
Game of Kings.
6 degrees of Derville Malton. Ladies and gentlemen, where I give Vincent 2 actors and he has 6 films or less to connect them to the father of Afrofuturism, one Derville Martin.
Someone who embodies black science fiction.
If there was ever a man ahead of his time,
oh yeah,
it was Derville Martin.
That's right. He's both a robot and an alien.
He was. Keeping it in theme, ladies and gentlemen, we are reviewing tonight The Creator. Written and directed by Gareth Edwards and starring one John David Washington.
John David Washington.
Vincent.
Yes.
Connect Derville Martin to
What's the theme?
I'm about to tell you.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Connect Derville Martin to these other 3 named actors.
Oh, I thought you might do nepotism, but you said 3 name actors.
Yeah.
All right, what we got?
Starting with, in 6 films or less, connect Derville Martin to David Hyde Pierce.
Oh, you are killing me with the actors that we only really know about from television.
But you know him from the movies.
What is he in the movies? What is the last thing he was in?
In the movies?
That's just other than he's like halfway retired and
The last movie. Well, he's in post-production on a movie, but the last movie that he was in was The Perfect Host from 2010, which actually is a creepy movie.
Right, so he hasn't been in a movie in like.
Perfect Host was creepy. He's the villain in that movie.
Why do I hear his voice? He said 2010, so he wasn't one of the apes in Planet of the Apes.
No.
He's in a cartoon.
He is.
This is how you get to David. This is how you get to David Alan Pierce.
Let's see if you know the cartoon.
Oh, I do, because it's such a weird movie that I've actually come close to choosing. It's so funny that was that Lisa was talking about the Goofy movie?
Yes.
Because we were talking about black cartoons. And I argued that this was a black cartoon. And the film I'm talking about
is, of course,
because Derville Martin is, or so how I want to get to this. Derville Martin is in Sheba Baby with Pam Grier. Pam Grier is in Hitman with Bernie Casey. Bernie Casey is in Cornbread Earl and Me with Lawrence Fishburne. And Lawrence Fishburne is in Osmosis Jones with David Hyde Pierce.
Very good. Very good.
Which is a weird. Did you see it?
I love that movie.
I mean, you know, you ain't seen it. It's because
I didn't see Officer and a Gentleman.
I mean, you have to admit, Osmosis Jones is a strange film.
It's a strange movie.
It's like half live action. It's a cartoon. The high concept is kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
Because David Hyde Pierce plays like a cough.
Yeah, he's like a capsule.
A cold capsule. A cold capsule. Like, how is this a thing?
Well, Chris Rock plays a germ.
Right.
A cop.
Not a germ. A white blood cell.
White blood cell.
Right.
And that's a cop.
Right. And they spun it off into a cartoon?
Yeah, that was a stretch. And Bill Murray is in the movie. It's a crazy movie, but I love that movie.
You know what I just finished reading? Like, literally just finished this afternoon. The cartoonist Box Brown has a book called The He-Man Effect, where he talks about advertising and the toy companies and how, you know, the deregulation of the 80s really opened it up for the half-hour commercials that you got with He-Man and G.I. Joe and the Transformers.
Right.
And it was, you know, that's really interesting, too, because that's when cartoons kind of became, well, they became soulless commercials.
Yeah.
How did the Osmosis Jones cartoon slip in there? Because that must have been like the 90s.
Well, because it was one, it was a movie adaptation. Two,
there's no way they made money off, like, there were no toys or lunchboxes.
No, but I wouldn't be.
Like, how did that become a thing?
Osmosis Jones kind of became like a perfect one. You got to think that sometimes these movies may have already had the deal sold beforehand. You know what I mean? That it was going to be
how
like an
pure
animated.
And uncut was the cocaine that someone was
because
snorting
it was a one,
that they thought this was going to work as a cartoon and a property.
I like the movie.
No, I like the movie too, but it's just a really strange movie.
I didn't realize how much of a flop it was. It cost $70 million. How much do you think it made?
50.
Lower.
40.
Lower.
30.
Lower.
20.
Lower.
Really?
$14 million.
Lynn, who was it for? For those of you that don't know, Osmosis Jones is a film where Bill Murray plays a disgusting, gross slob in live action.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other portion of the film takes place inside his body.
Right.
Where his body is his organs are like a city.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Rock voices a white blood cell, which the way the concept is that the white blood cells are like the police.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bill Murray gets sick, his kid makes him take a cold capsule. And that's who David Hyde Pierce voices.
Right.
And Lawrence Fishburne is like anthrax or...
It's like a virus.
He's like a virus. And then the whole movie is about them trying to chase him down.
And you forgot, who's the mayor of the body?
I don't remember.
William Shatner.
Who was this film for?
Well, I think the idea...
Then it had a cartoon spinoff.
I think the idea was thinking that, you know, because remember, Bill Murray is running around because he has a cold, so he's got like a snot coming out of his nose.
Right, right.
The idea was like, you know, kids like gross stuff.
For like 12-year-olds.
Yeah, that was the idea. Now, I think that was the idea behind the whole thing. I think the movie itself aimed, believe it or not, a little higher because it's a little sharper and smarter than that.
Sure.
And then it doesn't hit, but... They've got sold this concept. It's an original concept. They put money in it. Let's try and get something back for all these, you know, character developments and cartoon sheets and
sure.
And the sets that we drew. So now let's dumb it down like we wanted for the kids and put it on Saturday morning. And unfortunately, it didn't hit then either. But
it was the most bizarre
thing.
And like you, I was a fan of it. I mean, you know me. It was like, this is the weird, like, how can I not be obsessed with this? This is the weirdest thing ever. Do you remember in the cartoon, the two characters?
You're talking about the movie now.
No, I mean the cartoon spinoff.
I never watched the cartoon spinoff.
So the concept, the concept of the cartoon spinoff, the two characters, Chris Rock's white blood cell and David Allen Pierce's cold capsule, somehow jump from Bill Murray's body
into the daughter,
into a kid.
It wasn't even his kid, because he had a kid in the movie.
I don't remember if it was his kid. I remember it was a kid, because concept was like Bill Murray was basically had like his body was like 70s New York. Mm-hmm. So it was all gross and dirty. Mm-hmm. And then they jumped to a kid and the city was cleaner and more pristine. So then it was like a culture clash between these two grizzled cops.
Oh.
But in a kid's body.
Interesting.
But now the whole thing was a cartoon. No, it wasn't interesting. It was just strange.
I'm saying in the chat, Daryl Charles, what's up, my man?
Hey, what's up,
Daryl? He says the cartoon was actually low-key educational.
I will take your word for it, Daryl.
Well, it did, because you started learning about the body and you learned how certain things worked and things like that. I thought it was kind of interesting.
I could not believe what was happening with this thing.
And it was well animated.
Sure, sure.
It was. But as
David
an animation
Allen
fan.
David Pierce is in that.
David Hyde Pierce.
David Hyde Pierce. David Hyde Pierce. Is in the,
he's
what else,
the voice.
What else is he in, you that know, I would have known?
What he's in.
Because I pulled that one. That was a pull. I had to pull that.
That was a pull.
Yeah.
That was a pull. But what he was in when you were saying, thinking voice, his voice, uncredited, is in Hellboy.
Right, because he plays
Abe Sapien. He's the voice of
Abe.
How
is he uncredited?
Because he's not the body. And he didn't want the credit, because all he was doing just was the voice work. And what's his name? The guy from Discovery, who plays Doug. I'm sorry.
Is it Doug Jones?
Doug Jones.
Yeah,
Doug
Jones.
He actually is doing the body.
Oh, you know what? That's probably what I was thinking about.
See, that's where I thought you.
Boy.
Yeah, that's what, when you were saying, I hear his voice, I said, I know you do.
But somehow I saw him, he was Cock Diesel.
Because
remember, the pill was Cock Diesel.
Because
he was a pill.
But also, like,
the strangest film.
But he was a cold pill, but yet he had a pill for everything, because he would shoot them.
Right.
Because he was like a Terminator.
He was basically a robot.
I love the purest, most uncut cocaine.
Who comes up with this?
I love Osmosis Jones.
All right, so he's going to be a pill, but then his arm is going to be guns. And the guns are going to shoot out other pills. And Chris Rock. He's going to be a detective. And his whole body is the city. But the inside is cartoons.
But we got Bill Murray with a running nose.
And Bill Murray. And remember, he was like eating hot dogs off the ground?
Because he was a pig.
He was
disgusting. And sometimes they would get like a real close up of his mouth.
And it was like stuff hanging
all in his teeth. Oh my God. Oh, I'm making myself sick.
And his teeth. Get his people on the phone. You know what? I'll just run over and talk to him. It'd be quicker if I run over there.
You know, it's probably true, because the producers of this are the Farley brothers.
See? You know, they don't make movies like that anymore.
They don't. They really don't.
They really don't.
They really don't.
They really don't.
All right. Continuing on.
Okay.
Number two. It's six films or less. Connect Dervil Martin. To this great three-named thespian.
Another three-named actor.
Keegan-Michael Key.
Oh.
This should be easy.
Well, it's easy for a couple of reasons. I mean, you know, obviously I could go to Jingle Jangle.
Mm-hmm.
Or quietly, Keanu.
Mm-hmm.
Keanu. But I've been thinking, it's so funny. I just say they don't make films like this because, you know, Dune has been on my mind for this reason. I'll say in a second because, of course, what is this, Keegan?
Keegan-Michael Key.
Yeah, Keegan-Michael Key is in Wonka with Timothée Chalamet, who is in...
Oh, that's right, he is.
And he's in Dune with Oscar Isaacs, who's in Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, with Billy Dee Williams, who's in The Final Comedown, with Derville Martin.
Look at you going in reverse.
But I was thinking, you know, Dune has been on my mind, and I've been trying to figure out, like, as much as I enjoy Dune, I'm realizing that it's already slipping out of my consciousness.
This
and David Lynch is replacing. And what it really comes down to is, all jokes aside, like we were just talking about with Osmosis Jones, as much as I enjoyed Dune, mm-hmm. and it's so well made in the craft, that's just strangeness that the books have. You get more in David Lynch's version.
Mm-hmm.
Like as much as I love
it. And thus makes that more memorable.
And it makes it more memorable. And in a lot of ways, it captures the spirit of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the end of the day, Dune is just really slick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really kind of well made, really, mm-hmm. you know, it's just sort of pristine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like it's really pretty to look at.
I get it.
But
that's what I thought of the first one.
Right.
Like it.
Right.
But
like you look at it and you know, because of the film, and I'm following like all these Dune accounts, people are showing clips from the David Lynch one, and half of them are people going, ha ha, look at this dumb David Lynch one. But like the banana stuff in the David Lynch one are mm-hmm. It's like this is what's gonna stay with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that's how you get to Keegan-Michael
Key.
Keegan-Michael Key.
Very good, Vincent.
Right.
Well done.
Timothée Chalamet, who was in Dune with Oscar Isaacs.
All right.
Star Wars with.
And that is 6 degrees of Derville Martin, ladies and gentlemen. Well done, Vincent.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Now it is time for us to get to our review of The Creator.
We'll be right back with our movie review after we step to these messages.
Peaceful place in the sky.
Are you going to heaven?
No. You gotta be a good person to go to heaven.
So, we're the same. We can't go to heaven because you're not good. And I'm not a person.
The Creator. A 2023 American science fiction film directed, written, and co-produced by Gareth Edwards. Stars John David Washington. As a future war between the human race and artificial intelligence rages on, ex-Special Forces agent Joshua is recruited to hunt down and kill the Creator, the elusive architect of advanced AI. Starring John David Washington, he is supported by Gemma Chan,
mm-hmm.
Allison Janney, Ken Watanabe, And Madeline Univoyles, 2023's The Creator, again written and directed by Gareth Edwards, was the choice of Lynn Webb. Lynn, as we begin Octavia April, how would you like to start our conversation around The Creator?
I just missed seeing The Creator in the theaters. There was actually a night that I was had planned to go to the film, to the movie, to see it. And it had just moved, just left the theater that I was going to. And I was already at that theater. So I just, I'll watch another movie.
Okay.
So I just missed my opportunity to see it in the theaters. And it wasn't so much that this was a movie that I was yearning to see because of the movie trailer. This is an original story. It's not adapted by anything. So it was an original story that I was just coming too cold. I'm a fan of Gareth Edwards as a director of A Star Wars Story, Rogue One. But it's a movie that from the trailers looked really interesting and looked good. Like, it's a good looking movie. So in fairness, I said, well, I think I may want to watch that movie. And it looks so good, I want to see it on the big screen. Like, they want you to.
Sure.
But I missed my opportunity. So here we go. Fast forward to now watching it on television. And fortunately for this film, Gareth Edwards, who is such a visionary director, as good as this movie looks, it still looks just as good on television. Not for nothing nowadays, ladies and gentlemen, watching films on television is almost akin to watching it in the movie theaters because of the size you can get on televisions now.
Sure.
But it is a beautiful, beautiful film. This film, as you said, set in the not too distant future of 2066. Mm-hmm. But 2065, it starts off. And then it takes a 5-year jump from there. Where at that point, there has been this basically revolt in America and in most of the world against AI, which had over the years, starting in, you're led to believe, in like the 50s with the advent of like robots and things, become more and more a part of our life.
Right, because there's actually an alternate history.
Alternate history. So much so that in the years of that we're living in now, the 2010s and 2020s, AI are almost like they live with us. They are the person next door. They are their own, you know, race, quote unquote, of in this world that are living and breathing and have lives and feelings and affections and a whole nine. They are another life form, seemingly. But over the years, from there to there is a revolt, a turning of the tide against AI, which leads to a massive explosion, nuclear explosion in Los Angeles, which kills 1 million people. And I'm not giving anything away, ladies and gentlemen, because this is literally the first 5 minutes of the movie. This is all backstory for what gets you to 2065, where the AI and the who are this race of people are literally being hunted down by America. And there are special forces that are that have come together to hunt down AI. However, there is a land in quote unquote New Asia where AI is embraced, where they are seen as for the developed life form that they are, and they are safe. Yet America don't care. They go in there to get that AI ass because of what they did to LA, and they feel like it's only just a matter of time before AI will take over all of New Asia and then have their get their comeuppance on America. Meanwhile, the people in in New Asia, they're living their life. They're just living it, outside of having to run and try to make it to New Asia. They're just and having to run from American forces that are trying to hunt them down. They're just trying to live.
Right.
They're just trying, you know, just trying to get along.
Right. In harmony with the AI, humans and AI.
And there are humans that are, you know, and like, hey, we don't believe what's going on there. We will help you as much as we can. And in so doing, there is mingling, they're cohabitating, there is mating, there is lives, there are families that are being built. And into this world comes John David Washington's character as Joshua, who is undercover, you learn in the first 5 minutes of the movie. I'm not giving anything away. Undercover to discover the creator of this, of the ultimate AI, what makes the AI the life forms that they are. And in his undercoverness, which we learned has been for years, he has developed a relationship with a woman and who is pregnant with their child. And he is kind of like maybe ambivalent about his mission a little bit. Well, you're led to believe that maybe he's ambivalent. But nevertheless, Allison Janney, who plays his big boss, is like, no, we got to make this move. Eventually they make this move. In doing so, John David Washington, Joshua, he loses his wife. Cut to a year later, he doesn't care about the mission. He lost his wife. He lost his baby to be, he doesn't care. But Allison Janney comes to him, says, yo, but I think she's still alive. I think you can get her out of there. And we think we found the creator. She can point us to him. You go there, get your wife, drop this beacon. We'll come in, get the creator. It'll be done. That is basically the story. Now he goes on a mission to find the creator. And if you've seen the trailers, while he's going to find the creator, he comes across a young girl who comes to be named Alfie, young girl AI, who he then has to take on a quest, go with him on his quest to find the creator. And what you learn is that Alfie is the chosen one of the AI, the person who has been ordained or destined to free AI because of some amazing powers that Alfie has. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Avatar, The Last Airbender. Welcome to The Golden Child. Welcome to pretty much a ton of other movies where there is a young child with amazing powers who has a reluctant, you know, father figure that has to get them from point A to point B to save the world. And overlaid on all of this in the creator is little pastiches of, believe it or not, Apocalypse Now, Platoon, and every other Vietnam movie that you have ever seen. Because the AI, by living who live in New Asia, for some reason, almost all of them are represented as either Asian or kind of like a mix, a blend of Asian and some other ethnicity in there.
Did you watch with the subtitles on?
I Not for the whole movie.
Yeah, I had him on, and people were speaking Japanese. People are.
Oh yes, well yeah, I did see that.
Speaking Vietnamese. Yeah.
Yeah, and even some of the like, and the AI, there are AI that present as human in facial, and then there are AI that present straight up as like robots. As robots.
Yeah.
But speaking English, so yeah. They're not speaking like, you know, robot. They're speaking like, you know, with accents. Mm-hmm. But even these quasi Asian presenting AI, they live in, like huts or like villages. Mm-hmm. They live in villages.
Rice paddies,
you know, which is interesting that you're seeing this AI eating, which then calls to images of almost every Vietnam movie that you have ever seen, along with the same images of those villages being bombed. And that is what you see a lot in this movie as well. And yet, with this movie that is very derivative of other movies plot-wise that I've seen before, with this overlay of this Vietnam, not too subtle subtext, you know, that is laying over it. And with the presentation that Gareth Edwards brings to this film, because it is a gorgeous movie, and the world building and specificity of the environment that it creates is astonishing, and it is something that you could literally like sit back and just kind of like watch this movie. You talk about watching it with the subtitles. You could watch this movie with the sound down and just kind of like maybe get lost in the visuals, you know. And even some of like just the landscapes that they go to, because you know. But with all of that, it is still a movie that left me 100% cold. I just could not, I did not feel any real connection to this movie. John David Washington, I'm going to talk about him in a minute, but you talked about some of the co-stars, character actors in this film. Ken Watanabe, who shows up in this film, is one of the AI. Ken Watanabe is always a welcome figure in a movie. But he's gotten to a point to me that, frankly, I think Morgan Freeman in his more recent years has gotten to.
That's a good comparison.
Where he's kind of a little bit one note, you know, different dressing, different movie, but kind of playing the same kind of character. And not that there's anything wrong with it, because the man is a good actor and he definitely has paid his dues. But I've seen this before. Yeah. And in a movie that has got a lot of I've seen before, okay, Ken, I could do it. You're not doing anything for me. Allison Janney, maybe one of my 10 favorite actors of all time. I love Allison Janney. I've loved her since I, like most people, were introduced to her on The West Wing and have followed her career ever since. Honestly, I have to take that back. I was actually introduced to her in the Howard Stern movie, Private Parts. And then she got The West Wing. And I was like, that's the woman from Private Parts. And look at her go. And she had multiple Emmy Awards ever since. And I think she may have even brought home an Oscar. I know she's got multiple Emmy Awards. Allison Janney, welcome in every movie. First time I've ever seen her play like a heavy in a film. She does okay with it. I don't think this movie, again, not story-wise, plot-wise, not doing anything new, is giving her a lot to chew on. You know, maybe she chews a little bit of scenery, but she's honestly not even given that much scenery to chew. So it seems like a little bit of a wasted opportunity as far as her being in this role. Gemma Chan, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. I've seen her before. Welcome. But she's in and out of the movie.
Yeah, she's not really.
She's in the movie for the first 10, 15 minutes, and then she's gone.
Yeah.
And I won't spoil it, but she's gone from the movie.
Yeah.
All right. So you don't get much with her. And then the young girl, Madeline Una Voiles, as Alfie, she's good. She's good. I don't pick on children, young actors. She's good for what she's given. She's not given a lot to work with. And sometimes she's given some of the more hokier lines.
She's a kid.
And she definitely has, there's times where she literally looks like Aang, the Avatar, sure, in some of her movements in this movie. So that was like, boy, like, you're really hitting it on the head with your inspiration in here, Gareth. Mm-hmm. But the person who you really are supposed to be following in this movie is Joshua, which is John David Washington. Now, John David Washington has made a name for himself in Hollywood outside of his father's shadow. He's famously the son of Denzel Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since he pretty much showed up on the scene in HBO's Ballers, he's done a good job of, he's made a name for himself.
Right. He was built in a career.
Malcolm and Marie on the Netflix film with Zendaya. Mm-hmm. He was in the Black Klansman, Spike Lee movie, Tenet, the star of a Christopher Nolan movie.
Mm-hmm.
Building a solid career for himself. Yet, and still in doing that, I haven't 100% ever connected to him. It's always been about the other people around him. Malcolm and Marie, he was okay, but it really was Zendaya that you couldn't take your eyes off of. Black Klansman, I'm an Adam Brody fan, so I'm watching him in that movie, right? Tenet left me cold, like a lot of Christopher Nolan films sometimes, so I couldn't even get through Tenet because he didn't have the gravitas to pull me into that.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, one, is the first movie that I've ever saw where he definitely reminded me of his father.
Yeah.
Because there were moments where I was not looking at the screen.
Yeah.
And I heard somebody talking.
Yeah. I said the exact same thing.
That's Denzel.
Yeah.
That is Denzel. He sounds like Denzel. I think there are moments where some of his father's mannerisms are seen in this movie. So this is the first one where I really was remembering, oh, I see your daddy. I hear your daddy there.
Mm-hmm.
I hear it. But unfortunately, what I was also hearing is like, that was your daddy when he did his version of this movie, which was the Book of Eli. And there's something about Denzel, because Denzel is, we know he's charming.
Mm-hmm.
We know he's charming. But there's something about behind the twinkle in Denzel's eye that is charming as it is, and as brilliant as his smile it is, there's something going on behind there, and you don't know what it is. And you want to see, you want to find out, which is why you hang on his every word, which is why you can't take your eyes off him when he's in the movie, which is why he threatens to steal movies when he co-stars with other people.
Mm-hmm.
John David Washington he doesn't have that, which is not necessarily a knock against him, because how many people have what Denzel have?
Sure.
But there's something there when I look him in the eye as he's acting, and I felt this in almost every film that I've ever seen him in, there's a disconnect. It just doesn't connect with me. And because it's not connecting, I find myself seeing the acting and not feeling the performance, not there with him. He's not given much opportunity to develop any type of chemistry with Maya, the Gemma Chan character. So I won't knock him that they don't have any chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
He has some chemistry with Alfie, but I still didn't really like. They're definitely, he's supposed to be bringing on, like, you know, these movies, you've seen him before. He's the father figure.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't really feel it. I didn't feel that connection. At the end of this movie, there's scenes that tug at you a little bit. And yeah, because they are deliberately pulling the heartstrings.
Sure.
God damn it. Okay, you got a little bit out of me, but you didn't get tears. But now I'm maybe feeling it a little bit. But bruh, by the time we've got here, this movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes into it, and I'm just like, can we are we over? Are we done yet? That's what I'm waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it is a shame because it is such a gorgeous movie that I found and the world building visually is so stunning. That is a movie that I found myself wanting to like, but I felt like, I think a little bit kind of like what you're feeling with Dune, even though you liked it because it is a story that you
sure,
did like.
Sure.
But the most recent adaptations of Dune, and this is certainly how I feel about the first Dune, because that's the one that I watched. Beautiful movie. Can't knock the scenery. Mm-hmm. Can't knock it at all. I also feel this about Apple's Foundation and why I can't find myself mm-hmm. returning to that.
That's a good pull as well for this
conversation. Gorgeous ass movies, mm-hmm. but for some reason, they're so pretty.
There's a sheen
mm-hmm. that just doesn't give me a gateway into really caring about anything that's happening. And I found myself with this movie like, wow, this is really cool. I just wish I cared more.
Right.
And I just didn't.
I almost parallel exactly your read on this film with, you know, very little variation. I, like you, like John David Washington,
mm-hmm.
but his performances have been very okay to me. I have to say, I actually like John David Washington in this more than I've liked him in anything.
Okay.
And much like you, I heard his father.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw his father a lot of times. And much like you, I immediately said, it is unfair to compare him to his father.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
But, you know, having said that, I thought he did fine for what this role was. I think this is a role, much like you, just like you said, this is a story that, except for one or two plot points, you know exactly what this story is within 15 minutes
mm-hmm.
of the movie start. And that's not necessarily a knock.
No.
Because I also think that Gareth Edwards was much more interested in this world, A,
mm-hmm.
and in the questions, the sort of philosophical, ethical questions that are being raised about artificial intelligence
mm-hmm.
and personhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of it was way more interesting to me than the plot itself. Much like you, I think Allison Janney is the best thing acting wise in this film. So much so that even though she's the antagonist, even though she's the heavy, I wanted a version of this movie from her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she was such a gift to this film. Like again, she's the heavy, she's the military. Like, you know, John David Washington's Joshua is going to turn on the military. Mm-hmm. And but there was way more nuance to her character's motivations and the way her character moved. Like, I was so pleasantly surprised when she didn't die at the point in the movie where the military unit that the hero comes with usually dies.
Yeah, yeah.
And when she didn't die, that was, I actually wrote in my notes, oh, wow, I'm so happy she's going to stick around. But I think the world building is spectacular. And you talked about films and that this movie sort of references. And I'll add to that, I think this has Blade Runner mm-hmm. in its DNA. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think this has Edward's previous film, Rogue One, in its DNA. Like one thing that I thought he did really well is, and the reason why I think Rogue One is the best Star Wars movie. I think oftentimes when conflict is shown in science fiction, the creators tend to focus on the pew pew in the laser guns. Mm. And there is a thoughtfulness to the way weapons and fighting and conflict work in Rogue One and in this that I appreciate it. Like I said, this looks like this was the product of people who thought about how can we use this technology to kill other people? Like the weapons made sense. The bombs made, the combat made, it did like, you know, the way they fought made sense to me.
Well, there's this one deal, like the bomb that goes running into the building when you could just shoot the bomb that you've been shooting.
Yeah, but something that you shoot goes straight. Something that runs goes around. And speaking of the ethical dilemma, I love the fact that as much as America was saying, oh, we've disabled AI, there is no AI. You see you see the fact that you can't stop the march of technology. And I love that moment where the two bombs run in, but you realize they've been anthropomorphized, which is a really hard word for me to say. And that, you know, the one bomb says, it's been a pleasure serving you and runs in. And again, Allison Janney is such a great actress. You see this split moment recognition where she says, well, shit, this is AI. Like this is a robot right before it runs in and kills itself. Just visually, as you said, it's a beautiful film. The location in New Asia is a wonderful change from what we often see in these future settings. I do like the fact that the vast majority of the cast is people of color. And, you know, speaking of this being something that we talk about in Octavia April, I think John David Washington being a black man as the protagonist completely changes the dynamic.
That's true.
Like if he was a white actor, or even you think about, speaking of Blade Runner, in a lot of ways, the way that Harrison Ford as America's favorite white man in Blade Runner works, it's, you get this different dynamic with John David Washington being a black man. And then, you know, just the fact that, so what did I name check? I named Blade Runner. I name checked Blade Runner. I name checked, Rogue One. I think this is something that kind of continues a really interesting conversation of a film that I think has gotten a muted response, but I think it's aged really well. Steven Spielberg's AI. Like this sort of, you know, and even the way you described it, where it's almost this inverse of Terminator, where we were all scared of the machines rising up and, you know, Skynet's going to kill all of us. And, you know, this is a bit of a spoiler. You come to find out in this film that this nuclear holocaust that kind of jumped off this war wasn't
It wasn't AI.
It wasn't AI. It was human error. Mm-hmm. But because humans, we're scared, we murder, we this, that, and the other. Like, there's this wonderful line that I kind of underlined and circled, and I said, instead of kind of rehashing these plots that we've seen so many times, I was like, this should have been the through line where at one point, one of the AI characters, I actually think it's Ken
Watanabe,
says to Joshua, we're going to win this war. And when we win this war, what's going to happen to the West? And he says, nothing. Because we don't,
we're not in this to win.
To win. Like, we just want to live in peace. And I said, that's so much more interesting.
Yeah.
Something like, another robot movie, another AI movie that I think kind of speaks to this. Did you see Her?
Yes. Yes.
Where Her, spoiler for Her, and it's a spoiler, but Her is really a movie that you don't need to know the plot.
Right.
Where like the AI gains sentience, mm-hmm. and they become these kind of super omniscient beings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they leave. Like, how arrogant are we that we think that AI is going to rise up and the first thing they want to do is enslave us? Like, no, we just want to live in peace. So that I have to say, I thought the pluses outweighed the minuses. Like, I walked away liking this film, but I also know that I am much more interested in this film as part of a cultural conversation that I've been interested in since Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
And as a film on its own, I don't know if I would recommend it.
Well, that's interesting. So you land on liking it.
I liked it. But again, I you hear me talking, like I have a science fiction class that I teach. Like, I immediately said, oh, I can fit this in this slot.
Right.
If I start with Blade Runner and I show AI and then we do Her and then we do a couple of episodes of Black Mirror and then I'll end with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then your final paper is cumulative and you have to use 3 texts. And I give them some texts that fit together like a puzzle.
Okay.
But as just, okay, hey, go and watch The Creator. I don't know because
you don't know because
like
that.
You said, it is 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's very pretty, but after about an hour, it's just very pretty. Like, oh, it's still pretty.
And
it's not like David Lynch's Dune, where like 2 hours into it, you've got a weird murder child with blue eyes. My brother sends his greetings. And you're like, this is so weird.
Make it sound so much more interesting than I found that movie to be.
Al-Muad'Dib sends his greetings. David Lynch's Dune is that business. That is that work.
Yes.
Sting is all greasy and got on like a Speedo. Sting has on a Speedo.
Well, that is prime Sting.
And spiked hair.
That's prime Sting, man. He is feeling himself.
Does his uncle want to have sex with him? What is going on with the...
Everybody wanted to have sex with Sting.
Conan's. This is so bizarre.
Everybody wanted to have sex with Sting. It's interesting you talk about how much you like Rogue One.
It's my favorite Star Wars movie.
It surprises me that who would have thought that this movie would be prettier than a Star Wars movie? Like, this is prettier than Rogue One.
Well, I think part of what Gareth Edwards did, and it kind of makes Rogue One stand out, is that, it's this tension in Star Wars where you've got, like, these space wizards with laser swords kind of fighting and this, that, and the other. But then on the other end, like, you have this really pretty, it's like this insurgent rebellion that is using asymmetrical warfare and it's murder and you know, and Garrett Edwards leans on that part, which is why it makes it so evocative at the end when Darth Vader shows up, where you're like, oh, right, it's space wizards with laser swords too.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, he made the non-pretty Star Wars.
Yeah, but I think he needed to rough things up a little bit here in the creator with his own story.
I think that's a good critique.
Yeah, he needed to rough things up. I mean, and definitely could have cut a good half hour off this movie.
Well, how much do you like the world building?
We talked about Alice and Janney being the best thing in the movie.
Yeah,
but she's the heavy. So she's going to get her comeuppance, and she does. And there's still a half hour to the movie.
Yeah,
and so now you've got to kind of like build up another bad guy, and they don't ever really build up a bad guy because it's just about
the big ship. Look, this film could have used a good editor. The actual movie doesn't start, frankly, for almost a half hour.
Well, yeah, that's
like
true,
it's too. All this preamble and prologue and you know, you get
the prologue is not that long.
No, you get the info dump.
Yeah, at the beginning,
the alternate history.
Right,
you get this setup with him when he's undercover.
I didn't then mind that.
No. I didn't mind it. I'm just saying, you understand, like, you see, like, there, you see there are moments where it's like, okay, you didn't need to do all this.
Okay.
And then to your point, the film ends no less than three times.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But I do like the world building. I did, but, you know, I guess the question becomes, however, would you recommend The Creator?
I can't recommend The Creator.
Okay.
I can't. I hear everybody just coming down at me. Of course you can't, Len. You don't like anything.
It's true. You don't like anything. I mean, that's just the truth.
I do like some things. Well, I just
didn't like this.
Didn't like The Creator.
Which, like, you don't like many things.
I can't recommend it. It's a beautiful film.
It's beautiful.
Here's what I'll say.
Okay.
I'll recommend The Creator to a film class.
Okay.
A class on film to see how world building can be done.
Sure.
How it can be displayed on screen. I'll give you that. I think there's a fair amount of you know, visual effects in here, but I think there's a fair amount of practical effects in here
that
play a lot of the you talked about the world building, but the design work on this, like the big ship Nomad, that is a piece of architecture.
I mean, the simulants
themselves,
not to be confused with the replicants from Blade Runner.
Of course not. The armament, the tanks, the police vehicle, kind of like Bat Tumbler, the police Tumbler that they're driving. It's like there's some. Now that I think about this, Tumbler, he was pulling from a whole lot of I can't recommend The Creator. I can't.
Yeah, that's fair. I agree with you. I agree. Like I said, as a distinct, discrete film, I would not recommend it. I think as part of an ongoing conversation, if you are interested in science fiction and how it reflects our values and it reflects society, I think, again, it you know, the films that we've talked about, like I think you know, Terminator is very much an 80s film, and that sort of anxiety that we felt about computers and this, that, and the other, and way we sort of weren't open to granting personhood to computers, and we feared them. You know, it was before people had computers in their homes, as opposed to last year, where we're at the point where all of us have a personalized computer in our pockets, many of us in our cars, in our homes, and they feel like if you and I have the exact same make and model phone, we can't switch phones because my phone is my phone and your phone is your phone, and it's all very personal. So I think as part of that conversation, it works really well. But it has to be part of that conversation because, frankly, even as a film that examines the ethics of artificial intelligence and, again, who we grant personhood, I'll tell you something that has come out that I think does it in a much more nuanced fashion if people aren't scared of cartoons, and that is the anime Pluto. Which is you know, an adaptation of the manga that is on Netflix right now, which which spends like 10 episodes talking about some, like, you know, what, how do we grant personhood to something?
Yeah,
but much like you, it's very pretty. But there is a sheen to it that, you know, frankly, I'm finding more and more in you know,
and it keeps you at a distance.
Keeps me at a distance.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I agree with you.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That is our review of The Creator. If you don't want to take our word for it, please go out and check it out. It is out there available for you, streaming someplace very readily. All right, that'll do it for tonight's episode of the Michelle Mission. Before we tell you what we're going to be reviewing next week in Octavia April, I invite you to send us all of your thoughts on how Vincent doesn't like anything. Email us at the Michelle Mission at gmail.com. That's MICHEAUXMISSION at gmail.com. Subject line, Vincent, I hate you. Just send it in.
Sure.
Dylan is checking the inbox as we speak, ladies and gentlemen. You can always, if you don't feel like writing a letter, hit us up on social media. Hey, Vincent, are you out of your mind? Sure. You can find him on Twitter. Sure. You can find us on Facebook.
Sure.
You can find us on Instagram, at Michelle Mission.
Sure.
Just make sure that you go at Michelle Mission.
Sure.
Hey, Vincent.
Right.
And then he will see it. Are you out of your mind?
Right. I'm the one that doesn't have joy in my heart. That's me.
There is nothing in his heart.
No,
you've heard it right now.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
He has nothing in his heart. And if you don't believe him, ladies and gentlemen, you can see his empty heart every Tuesday, streaming live here from Yunk Junk, Philadelphia's premier video podcast palace in Philadelphia. The Michelle Mission, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. We stream to YouTube. We stream to Twitter. We stream to Facebook. It's me and cold-hearted Vincent right next to me, liking nothing.
Nothing. Like, you think sometimes you would just for the joy of it. Like, just for the sheer joy and
just
wonder.
Just can't find it.
Like, just have some type of through line to your inner 10-year-old.
Obviously, you're
not me.
Not you.
Not me.
Not you. Not at all.
You just like things.
The Michelle Mission is also a proud member of The Podglomerate. ThePodglomerate.com. They make podcasts work, such as ours, despite it only having one heart. Which is mine.
One heart.
And
yes.
One dead space.
Dead space.
Which is Vincent.
Old dark place.
It is.
Which no light shall penetrate.
But perhaps we can bring some love to Vincent's heart next week, ladies and gentlemen, as we review his choice.
Yeah, oh yeah.
For Octavia April. Next week, we'll be reviewing Denzel Washington in The Book of Eli.
Book of Eli.
Right here on The Michelle Mission. Till then, he's Vincent, I'm Len, and in parting we say,
see you when it's time to meet again.
The Michaud Mission is produced by Len Webb and Vincent Williams, with co-production by Mo Poplar. Check out Mo's family travel podcast, Bon Amigos, at ashyfeet.com. Original music is provided by Alexa Gold. Visit Alexa Gold Music at Bandcamp for more of her melodies. The Michaud Mission is edited by Len Webb and produced for YouTube at YunkJunk. Visit Dylan at YunkJunk.com for more information.